it's hard to argue against keeping the facilities warm and the lights on.
Legislators await the governor's signature on a bill that would help fix deteriorating rural schools. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after four police shootings this year, Anchorage's police chief calls for a broader conversation.
And it's what are we doing as a community that's broader? Who are we going to sit down at the table with and have like a real discussion?
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly. Many kids in Alaska go to school in buildings with leaking roofs, broken water pipes, and failing foundations. During a committee hearing in March, Senator Lyman Hoffman told colleagues it's an issue that bubbled to the top during this year's legislative session.
Even though the whole state is having a problem balancing its checkbook, at the top of the list is education.
As Emily Schwing reports for KYUK, the education budget waiting for a signature from Governor Mike Dunleavy could more than triple what lawmakers allocated last year.
This month, the state legislature sent a budget bill to Governor Mike Dunleavy. It includes more than $148 million to help repair deteriorating public schools. If Dunleavy signs off, the money could pay for dozens of school infrastructure projects.
I do appreciate it.
Madeline Aguilar is the superintendent of the Cusbuck School District, located more than 200 miles west of Anchorage.
However, you know, the hole that the state is in as far as capital improvement for public schools across the state is so deep, so big that it's going to take a long time, I guess, to hit that word enough.
Aguilar has spent more than 2 years advocating for 9 rural schools in her district, including the school in the tiny roadless community of Sleetmute. For 2 decades, the district asked the state to pay to fix a leaking roof. That didn't happen, and now the whole school needs to be replaced because of damage. One lawmaker labeled Sleetmute's school the poster child for what's wrong with Alaska's public school infrastructure.
This isn't just about Cusbuck. This isn't just about Western Alaska. This is an Alaska problem statewide. I mean, it's the reality. And I truly believe that we have to keep telling the stories of our community. And I think that you did a great job setting that foundation and really spurring the conversation.
Last year, KYUK, ProPublica, and NPR reported a severe health and safety crisis inside the buildings used daily for public education. Some of the worst conditions exist inside rural public schools, where the majority of students are Alaska Native. That reporting also highlighted problems with the system school districts use to apply for maintenance and construction dollars. Back in March, lawmakers questioned Education Commissioner Dina Bishop about that process.
There is, I would personally say, a flaw in the system in the ranking that we are trying to fix.
This year, school districts requested more than $1.12 billion in infrastructure funding. That's the highest amount in decades. Lawmakers came back with an education budget that's much higher than last year's. But still, it only makes up 13% of the money school districts asked for statewide.
There's so many competing priorities in our state.
That's Senator Lukey Tobin, a Democrat from Anchorage. She chairs the Senate Education Committee. Tobin says state budget challenges mean everyone's competing for scraps.
There's so many things that any one person could point to and say, this is the biggest struggle or the biggest challenge Alaskans face.
In the absence of a permanent solution to pay for decades of backlogged major maintenance projects in schools, the legislature has relied on a few stopgap measures to help. Tobin, for example, led an effort this year to create a one-time grant program to help defray rising energy costs for school districts.
It's hard to argue against keeping the facilities warm and the lights on.
3 days before this year's session was set to end, Alaska's Senate voted to make Tobin's program permanent beginning in 2028. Governor Dunleavy has until early June to sign the budget lawmakers sent to his desk. According to Tobin, there's no indication this year that he won't sign off. But in all 8 years that Dunleavy has served as governor, he's used his veto power to cut state investment in public school infrastructure. In Anchorage, I'm Emily Schwing.
Anybody hoping to throw their hat in the ring to be Alaska's next governor, senator, congressman, or state legislator is running out of time. The deadline to run for statewide office is 5 p.m. on Monday. There are already 20 candidates running for governor and dozens more seeking other state and federal offices. And as Alaska Public Media's Eric Stone reports, there are three things to watch as the deadline approaches.
Thing one to look out for is late surprise entries. We've had several of those recently. Former Governor Bill Walker filed paperwork Thursday and says he'll most likely join the race for governor. U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan also has a new challenger, a Petersburg teacher who, in a fun twist, is also named Dan Sullivan. And there was yet another entry into the governor's race Friday as former state legislator Liesl McGuire filed a letter of intent, bringing the field of candidates to 20. McGuire spent 16 years representing Anchorage in the House and Senate, and in 2024 chaired the No on Two campaign. Opposing the repeal of open primaries and ranked choice voting. She says she'd like to build a better relationship between the legislature and the governor.
I don't approach leadership from a partisan point of view. I approach it from a people point of view and a problems and solutions point of view.
McGuire serves as a Republican in the state legislature, and she's still registered with the GOP, but she says she has reservations about the current direction of the party and hasn't decided whether to officially change her party affiliation before filing to run on Monday. McGuire does have a running mate, though, independent Elizabeth Rexford, who most recently worked as a legislative staffer for a Fairbanks Republican. And that brings us to thing two on the things to watch list, running mates. Candidates have to indicate who will run alongside them for lieutenant governor. And finding someone to put their life on hold to run for a relatively low-profile office where the pay is $140,000 a year is no small feat. That's according to first-time Republican gubernatorial candidate and Anchorage podiatrist Matt Halala.
I heard it from probably three candidates that it would be a big pay cut for them to become a lieutenant governor here.
Halala did eventually find a running mate in former Wasilla Republican Representative Jesse Sumner. Halala says he was looking for someone young, 30s or 40s, and he says Sumner's experience in government and the construction industry is an asset.
I have not known him long, but he's a perfect fit.
Two more made announcements in recent days, including Republican former Revenue Commissioner Adam Crum, who picked Bob Craig, a former VA hospital front desk clerk, who was most recently CEO of an Anchorage cardiology practice. Crum says he'd task Craig with leading a cost-cutting effort similar to Elon Musk's Department of Government Efficiency.
He's a great guy when it comes to leadership skills, organization, and process, understanding government function. And that's the key thing in lieutenant governor.
And Democratic Anchorage Senator Matt Klayman picked Sarah Skeel, the chief administrator for Providence Alaska Medical Center.
Sarah Skeel is just a very bright, talented, capable woman with really strong and vast experience in the healthcare field. I'm really pleased to have her part of the team.
Matsu Borough Mayor Edna DeVries, a Republican, named Talkeetna physician George Hightower as her would-be number two, according to the Division of Elections, and more are set to announce soon. Even then, some prominent candidates do not have anyone beside them on the ticket, notably Republicans Treg Taylor and Nancy Dahlstrom. Taylor and Dahlstrom didn't return phone calls on Friday. And that's thing three to watch, attrition. Will all the candidates who've announced a run actually make it to the August primary? Halala, the Anchorage podiatrist, says he expects some candidates to drop out ahead of the 5 p.m. Monday deadline.
And I'm sure they were maybe thinking the same about me. So I do still imagine at least three or four would maybe just let it expire. The ones that haven't filed yet.
He didn't say who. For now, though, with just a few days to go, the field is only growing. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Eric Stone.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the local tribe in Petersburg launches its first traditional canoe in a century.
It's a culmination of everything our ancestors have put before us.
That's ahead. Stay with us. Three climbers on Denali, North America's tallest peak, have died after a fall late Wednesday. The Associated Press reports that a Latvian mountaineering group released the information today. Mountaineering rangers rescued a fourth climber on Thursday. They were part of a 7-person Latvian mountaineering expedition traversing the West Buttress Route, the most popular route to the 20,310-foot summit. The fall happened near Denali Pass, which is at about 18,200 feet. More than 130 people have died on the mountain in the park's history. 1,000 to 1,200 climbers attempt to reach the top each year, mostly during May and June. 2 people died on Denali last year, both of them skiers. The Anchorage Police Department wants broader support and conversation around the behavioral health issues that Police Chief Sean Case says are driving high rates of police shootings. Case released new details today about the latest such shooting, which was the 4th so far this year. Alaska Public Media's Hannah Floor has the story.
Reports of gunfire brought Anchorage police to the city's east side early the morning of May 19th.
When the officers arrived on scene, the individual is still sitting on the ground on the side of the road.
That's Police Chief Sean Case at a press conference Friday describing the incident, during which police say officers shot and killed 33-year-old Emil McCord. Case says body camera footage shows McCord getting up, walking into the road, and raising his right arm toward the sky.
One of the commands is, drop it. I don't want to shoot you, drop it. And the officer at this point in time could clearly observe that he was holding a weapon, a handgun, in his right hand.
Case says McCord slowly lowered the handgun, pointing it at the officers, who then shot him. Case says the whole thing played out in less than 20 seconds, but he says it's part of a long-running problem in Alaska's largest city. Anchorage has some of the highest rates of police shootings per capita in the country. That's 17 in the last 2 years. After McCord's death, Chief Case called for a broader conversation about gun violence in the city. He says the high numbers are a reflection of behavioral health problems and substance misuse. He says it's time to start involving other organizations and affected groups. Case says he spends time with the family members of people shot by police, and they often tell him there were warning signs. Case says the police department wants to involve medical and behavioral health professionals and churches and schools.
There's only so much we can do in a 20-second call, you know, and it's what are we doing as a community that's broader? Who are we going to sit down at the table with and have like a real discussion?
The city has created several crisis response teams within various departments. The police department's mobile intervention team, known as MIT, is made up of officers paired with social workers and healthcare professionals. But MIT didn't respond on May 19th. Case says the intervention teams are limited in what they can do, and they don't work at night, even though that's when 2/3 of Anchorage police shootings occur. Case says the May 19th incident was unfolding too quickly, and there was a gun involved.
You know, this is an individual that's walking out into a roadway with a gun, and at that point, the communication really is addressing that immediate threat, which is drop the gun, put the gun down.
Case says the officers responded exactly as they were trained to. Still, one of the officers involved in McCord's shooting has shot 3 other people in the last 2 years. Case says while that may look like a statistical anomaly, there's a good explanation. Officer Jacob Jones works the night shift, and he's a canine officer. Case says canine officers are often the first to respond to high-risk calls.
I understand the frustration when we have these shootings. We're with you. The officers are involved in these incidences. The officer that's been involved in 4 of these, I can promise you where he's at is not in a great place himself.
The State Office of Special Prosecutions reviews every police shooting in Alaska and has ruled that all of the 17 that happened in Anchorage in the past 2 years were legally justified. The Office of Special Prosecutions has until early July to determine whether the shooting that killed Emil McCord was legally justified. As per department policy, Anchorage police are set to release video of the incident after that determination is made. In Anchorage, I'm Hannah Floor.
Golden Valley Electric Association said on Wednesday that the co-op will soon sharply increase how much it charges members to help pay for fuel to generate electricity. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
GVEA sent out emails to members that day stating the co-op will boost the so-called fuel and purchased power charge on Monday. CEO Travis Million advised members that it will be, quote, an extraordinarily large increase.
This is very difficult news to share. This is not positive news.
Million said in an interview Wednesday that the charge will go up by about 61% on June 1st. He says that'll cost the average residential customer nearly $46 more per month. He said the massive rate hike is needed because Golden Valley's been using its diesel-fueled generators more than anticipated. That's mainly because the co-op no longer has access to cheaper electricity from utilities in Anchorage and the Mat-Su due to dwindling natural gas reserves that they use to generate power.
So we're running those diesel units more to meet demand because we're not getting any energy from South Central.
In addition, the cold winter and cool spring weather required Golden Valley to generate more electricity than it had anticipated during those 3 months. That factor and an overall increased demand required the co-op to rely more on its diesel-fueled generators.
We did see just higher loads across the board on the residential and on the industrial side. We're just using more electricity than what we had traditionally seen historically.
And that happened just as the price of diesel skyrocketed, mainly because of a worldwide shortage of the fuel caused by the war in Iran.
When we filed our last cost of power adjustment end of February timeframe, fuel prices were about $2.50 a gallon for what we were buying for our power plants. Fast forward to today, it's $5.10 per gallon for that same fuel product. So more than double the cost of what we had projected during that timeframe.
Golden Valley's members already pay more for electricity than any of the other Rail Belt utilities, even more so now that the co-op is increasing the fuel and purchased power charge of their monthly bills. Million said Golden Valley's management and board aim to adjust that part of their bills so it'll cover the cost of generating or buying electricity in the coming fiscal quarter. He says when that doesn't work as planned, the co-op will keep its members informed. Million says that's what he's been doing in meetings over the past few months in Fairbanks and outlying communities, and he says he'll continue to do that.
As we continue through the summer, as we're seeing things shake out of what it's looking like, I will personally be communicating out to the membership on what we're seeing and what that's looking like going into the next quarter as well.
He says he also wants members who are having problems paying their electricity bills to contact Golden Valley to work out extended payment plans or other arrangements. Members who need help can contact Golden Valley. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
A bill to increase state funding for free legal aid to vulnerable Alaskans passed into law without the governor's signature last week. House Bill 48 allows the legislature to boost funding to the Alaska Legal Services Corporation, a nonprofit that provides free civil legal aid to low-income Alaskans. It targets issues like housing disputes, domestic violence, and tribal self-government. Maggie Hum, the corporation's executive director, says the bill's passing is a major milestone toward closing Alaska's gap in access to justice.
I think there is not always the recognition of how many legal problems individuals face, and particularly low-income individuals, and how impactful those legal issues, if they go unresolved, can be on a family.
Democratic House Representative Sarah Hannon sponsored the bill. It passed both bodies with Republican crossover support in early May. Hannon said the change will allow the legislature to provide more reliable support to the nonprofit that offers aid to low-income Alaskans who need legal aid but can't afford it.
The hope is this is a much more stable and predictable amount of funding from the state to assist Alaska Legal Services with delivering legal services to poor Alaskans.
The bill received pushback from some legislators who said they were concerned about the cost as the state grapples with a long-running structural deficit. Right now, state law sets aside 10% of the fees paid annually to the Alaska court system to go to the nonprofit. Once it goes into law, Hannon's bill amends state statute to increase that to 25%, providing an estimated $400,000 in additional funding. The change takes effect on August 23rd. Petersburg's local tribe launched its first canoe in a century last Sunday, setting out on a canoe journey to the biannual Celebration Festival in Juneau. Pullers from around the region joined the highly anticipated launch out of Petersburg, and dozens of people gathered dockside to see them off on the multi-day journey. KFSK's Olivia Rose reports.
It's a clear morning with calm seas at South Harbor. A group of canoes from several different communities are about to embark from Petersburg to paddle together to Juneau, camping and visiting villages along the way. It's a tradition known as journey. And Petersburg's local tribe says launching this canoe journey from the island town is a big deal. They believe it's the community's first official launch of this kind in recorded memory. And preparations are coming to a head at the harbor's boat ramp. Shoshani Brandon Ware loads supplies onto Petersburg's new Flinket-style canoe. It's fiberglass and 39 feet long.
Man, this ballast actually makes this canoe snappy. With all this water in here.
Ware is moving around cases of water bottles added for extra weight. That's because just 9 people will be in the canoe at a time, instead of a dozen like originally planned.
We make do with 9. We figured out we actually move this thing with about 5 people.
Ware is the skipper and the local tribal council vice president. He's been devoting a lot of time coordinating and preparing for today, from planning to paddle practice with the pullers.
We're making a journey of it, and it'll be a good time.
His two brothers are also at the ramp getting ready for the launch. Billy Ware is gearing up at the front of the canoe.
My English name is Billy Ware. My Tlingit name is Saguch, and we are going on this canoe journey today. This is a big, big thing. We've waited over 100-something years for this now. And it's a culmination of everything our ancestors have put before us. We are just trying to do the best with what they gave us, and they gave us a great foundation.
Billy and Brandon's brother, Adam, says he's excited too.
My name's Khatu Sab, and my government name is Adam Ware. Just kind of feels more surreal right now. It's actually happening, and all this planning we've put into it, it's just surreal to me that we're actually launching today.
He says the biggest concern has been the weather. The other handful of pullers at the ramp agree. But they're somewhat relieved knowing fishing vessels are traveling with the group as safety boats. It will take over a week to paddle more than 100 miles from Petersburg to Juneau. For many of the pollers, it will be their first time attending the Celebration Festival there. It's a big event that happens every other year, where thousands of people gather to honor and uplift Indigenous culture. Some travel for the occasion by canoe. Guchla Victoria Moore last went to Celebration in 2004. And this year is the first time with her son, Alex.
There is risk in this whole adventure, but I'm just thinking about all of us coming together, you know, and helping my son connect with a culture. You know, this is going to be a whole new experience. Alex's Tlingit name, Daha Guch. And with Alex, everybody's been so good about inclusion. For him, you know, he has autism, he has a different language than we do, you know, than out of the ordinary. So I'm just excited to see the joy in Alex and this, and for us just to create these memories together, you know, for the first time.
Moore puts on her life jacket when Stephanie Hayes, a friend who is a weaver, gives a quick parting gift.
This is a toque tassel from my first piece.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my gosh! Life jacket, because I want you to have peace from a chokat rope. Go with you the whole journey.
That is amazing. From your first piece.
From my first piece.
Oh my gosh!
I love you. Thank you, Alex. I got a rope to wear.
Oh my goodness!
On my first piece. So you have a chokat rope the whole way.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Alex. You'll have a good paddle this week.
There we go, all right. Let's untie and we'll head over.
More well wishes for the pollers happen over at the launch site. At the other side of the harbor, dozens of people gather throughout the upper and lower dock and gangway to witness the historic canoe launch.
Push up the dock, all right.
The ancestors are
going to
be with you all the way.
Ki Yalk is the Tlingit name of Petersburg's canoe. It translates to English as the killer whale canoe. Petersburg's group pulls the canoe into the middle of the harbor and joins 3 more canoes that came to town for the official launch. The groups all float side by side as their journey is blessed with a prayer.
Say Yak Wasatin.
Till we meet again, folks.
Can I get a hoo-ah?
Hoo-ah!
Keet Yauk, hold on.
Keet Yauk glides out first from the cluster, officially launching the canoe journey out of Petersburg. Canoe landing protocols happen in Juneau on June 2nd. Celebration kicks off June 3rd. Reporting in Petersburg, I'm Olivia Rose.
And finally tonight, we have a correction to a story from last night about federal grants to tribes to improve electric grids, which misstated the grant allocation for the 16-tribe consortium led by the Native Village of Council. The group has so far been awarded about $2.8 million for 2024 and are waiting to hear what will be allocated for 2025 and 26. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Emily Schwing and Hannah Floor in Anchorage, Eric Stone and Clarice Larson in Juneau, Tim Ellis in Delta Junction, and Olivia Rose in Petersburg. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us, news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Crystal Hyde. Casey Grove produced tonight's show, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.